This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, Irirangi Tumotu, MPR.
Kia ora and welcome to Reserved Recommendations. This is a show about great trash, difficult art, and our complicated relationships with art and culture. My name's Hugh, I'm the host of the show, and I'd like to take this opportunity to put in a very mild content warning for the show as a whole. Sometimes our recommendations on this show are reserved just because the thing that we're discussing is in some way not good, but sometimes there are aspects of the art or artist that may be confronting for some people. Check the episode descriptions for more information, and do be aware of your listening environment. We are back for another episode of Reserved Recommendations, and this evening it gives me very great pleasure to welcome back Morgan Davey. How's it going, Morg?
Oh, it's going very well. Hi, Hugh. It's nice to be back on Reserved Recommendations.
Yeah, well, I mean, you were among my first guests, so this is very cool. And we're talking about a movie again, which is also very cool.
Well, it is. I think just the concept of Reserved Recs, it makes me think of movies in a pretty profound way, because I associate them with kind of the video store, which was full of all of these weird, strange covers, and there was a lot of kind of trepidation involved in sorting through what was in there when I was young. So I think that's the medium that I turn towards from the very concept of what this is all about.
I think that's like an absolutely apt thing, actually, because that is absolutely an experience that I had. And, you know, my movie store exploration days were, as an example, at the point when anime was just starting to break into New Zealand, and no one had the faintest idea how to file stuff. And so you would get, like, in some video stores at least, you would get Studio Ghibli stuff next to, like, ultra-violent, gnarly 90s OVAs, because people had just gone, oh, it's that Japanese animation stuff the kids like, and they hadn't really worked out what anything was. It was very strange.
Yeah, I remember kind of coming up in the 80s, and it felt like the kind of the 70s era, where there was lots of scary stuff on TV, had kind of passed away, and television was quite anodyne at that time. So the introduction to horror that you had growing up in the 80s was that kind of at the beginning of Hollywood movies, there would usually be a really scary bit early in the Indiana Jones movies, or in the Time Bandits or whatever it was. These quite fun adventure flicks would always begin with something scary. So you'd get that. And then apart from that, it would be going into the video store and just looking at the covers. And that would be the other way you would get horror content, until you were brave enough to actually watch something for real. It was it really got the imagination going.
Oh, absolutely. And like, it's an interest, because at that point as well, like, the actual horror movies themselves are often kind of slapdash, or you know, making the most out of the least amount of material, you know. Certainly in the movie that we're going to discuss, which is Phenomena from 1987, I think. 1985. There is some, like, incredibly vivid, looking like barely diluted acrylic paint blood, you know, like there is some a very obviously fake head right at the start. What am I thinking of? I'm having too many thoughts at once. It reminded me of there's a video. It's quite old now in terms of YouTube video terms, by H Bomber Guy in collaboration with Shannon Strucci, who I've actually had on the show. You can go check out my conversation that I had with them about Lupin the Third. But they had this series called Scanline that I think they only ended up making two episodes of. And there was one which was talking about watching things like Alien on VHS. And the thesis of the video, and I think this certainly is a thing that probably would apply to Phenomena if I had watched it on VHS, is there are some movies that really benefit from that like loss of fidelity, you know, like the alien in Alien becomes literally an invisible ambush predator in VHS. When you watch it on Blu-ray, you realize that it's actually hanging out in the background of shots, and it's kind of easy to see if the fidelity is good enough. But and because you can see it more clearly, it's sort of more obviously a very tall man in a suit. But if you can't really see what's going on, it becomes this kind of extra thing. And I think Phenomena is a movie that's sort of made to be viewed that way. And I unfortunately watched it on streaming video, so I could see things a lot more clearly.
But, I think you're absolutely onto something there. I was just hearing the other day, I wish I could remember the source, that apparently VHS has been going up in enormous popularity amongst the younger crowd because you can watch kind of the ambient noise of the image is scarier for all of these horror movies.
Yeah, I would certainly believe it. I mean, there's that thing about from Brian Eno about like whatever the flaws are of any particular medium will become the aesthetic that the next generation craves, you know?
Yeah.
And so I could certainly see that. Before we get into talking about Phenomena, can I ask, like, had you seen it before? Were you big into Dario Argento, or did you just like see that it was there on Canopy and decide to check it out?
Well, I ended up watching Phenomena for the first time quite recently, just a couple months ago. And I watched it because it came up in there's a little Sunday Horrors group where we honour the great Sunday Horrors show on New Zealand television from many years ago. By on Sunday night, we find a movie that is out on some streaming platform easy to see, and we all watch it. And this one came up, and I'd never seen it, and I was looking forward to it because I had encountered Dario Argento a bunch of times before. Years and years and years ago, I watched several other of his movies, including particularly Suspiria, which is kind of probably his best known film, also the one that is most people's favorite of his works. And I'm happily going to put my hand up there. I love Suspiria. It is fantastic. So I've seen kind of not a huge number of his films. He's made a lot of them. I've seen maybe four of them, maybe five, but Phenomena felt like a gap for me. I remember hearing about it when I was watching those other films and even seeing clips from it. And the fact that it has Jennifer Connelly in the lead, who's obviously an actress who was a big deal in my growing up because of the Labyrinth film.
Yes.
It was just sitting there waiting and waiting and waiting. And so I very recently watched it, and it just so far exceeded isn't even the right words. Whatever expectations I had, it kind of went at right angles to them and to a completely different place. It was an amazing film. So, we're going to have an interesting chat about it, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So Suspiria is like the other Dario Argento movie that I've seen, but I am keen to see more. I really like that period of 70s movie making where things are very vibes, and Dario Argento is often a very vibes filmmaker. A lot of the stuff in his movies doesn't necessarily make rational sense if you stop and think about it. So you don't stop and think about it. Look at the fact that this Italian man has made like the most amazing colors happen for his murders, and you leave it at that. You can worry about thinking later.
Yeah. I do think that there is usually kind of a pretty clear and coherent plot that sits underneath his films a lot more than is initially apparent. He doesn't explain a lot of stuff. I kind of have pet theories for things that happen, or sometimes, as in Phenomena, there is kind of a bunch of stuff that happens at the start where this girl ends up in peril, and then she runs to another place and dies, and you wonder what's she even doing there, and why doesn't she go somewhere else for help? And the film does kind of have answers for all these questions, but sometimes it takes about an hour later that it drops that answer as a side bit of dialogue. So there is a logic to it. He's completely uninterested in ever explaining anything. And on top of that, as you say, there is a lot of vibes. There are a lot of choices that he makes that really don't make any sense and don't try to make any sense. And so it adds up to this crazy dreamlike soup of experience, and kind of almost all of the films I've seen from him are like that. Some of the early Giallo, more kind of traditional crime killer films aren't quite so dreamlike, but certainly the ones at this stage, they're very weird and just relish that weirdness.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so to give people a rundown, if you're not familiar with this movie, I believe it is unspoilable. I think so much of it is just the experience of seeing the images that Dario Argento has come up with. But the very, very brief run through is that Jennifer Connelly is a young girl who's been sent to an exclusive boarding school in the Swiss Alps. She can communicate with bugs for reasons that are never explained, although they are, you know, important for the plot. And she finds herself in the middle of a series of horrible murders, which she needs to solve with the assistance of a wheelchair-bound scientist played by Donald Pleasance, Blofeld himself, and his assistant chimpanzee, who is more pivotal in the plot than you would expect by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, that's a very creditable attempt to summarize what goes on in this film.
But I guess the reason I wanted to get that in was because I just talking about like the dreamlike stuff, and talking about Jennifer Connelly, who, if you are the right age to have experienced The Labyrinth at the right age, is an incredible figure for a lot of people. She, for me, is kind of emblematic of a lot of that dreamlike stuff. I looked up, just kind of idly out of curiosity, some reviews on websites, and there were a number of people kind of panning her acting in this movie and saying that she just kind of doesn't really respond to anything. But actually, that was something that I found quite powerful. She has this very kind of luminous, angelic quality to her face, particularly. She's, I think, maybe 2 years younger than she is in The Labyrinth. Like, it came out the year before, I think.
Yeah. I think she was 14 as this was filmed.
That's right.
And that's the age of the character as well, yeah.
And so she has this very sort of, like, almost, like, not quite human appearance. You know, she's sort of seems kind of like a dreamlike figure herself. And so the fact that sometimes she seems to be kind of floating through the movie and just kind of encountering the next thing that's happening just kind of fits with the vibe for me.
Yeah. I would absolutely agree with all of that. But I think kind of your description of her as sort of angelic and floating is absolutely on point. She's kind of shot like that a lot of times. Sometimes deliberately, because there are sleepwalking sequences which center on her character kind of literally becoming dreamlike and floating, and just the light is hitting her face and she's wearing these white floaty clothes and moving smoothly through environments. But then all through the rest of the film, just kind of that aura is still associated with her, the way that they light her face, the way that they kind of position her in the frame. I think they really, it's just a tremendous kind of coming together of the director of photography and the kind of the performance as well that she's given. And she's not like a great technical actor at this stage. She's 14.
No, but
she holds attention beautifully and she's absolutely committed. And I think there is an unfairness in those. Saying that she's not reacting or not engaging or whatever it is. I think she's doing really good work.
Yeah, that's right, because her character is also someone who's kind of set apart from the people around them. You know, she's at this prestigious boarding school because her unidentified millionaire rock star father has, I think, sent her there because she got in trouble at the last one. And she's also separated from all of the other girls by her affinity for bugs. She's shown right at the start of the movie, I think, talking to a bug in the bus and then letting it fly out the window. And that struck me as I'm not quite sure why I characterize it this way, but it feels Stephen King-y to me. Like the just kind of completely 90 degrees to logicness of it strikes me as just the sort of superpower that Stephen King would give someone.
That feels, it does feel very much like a kind of a Stephen King, like if Stephen King took an X-Men character, an X-Men mutant, and then put them in a Stephen King story, you would end up with something a bit like this in tone. Like he's got a few characters like that through his work, like Firestarter, where they have these powers. The powers are not super helpful, and they're a bit strange and weird. And yeah, this definitely hits that. And they never explain it. There's some gestures about the connection between the insects and the soul, and the fact that she's accessing this heightened state of awareness by her sleepwalking, and somehow that's also what the insects are connected to. There's a whole bunch of guff like that in the middle, where Donald Pleasance's character is kind of saying all these things that you nod and listen to, but it doesn't make any sense at all, and it's not really meant to. It's all just, as you say, it's all just vibes, and it's such a good watch.
Yeah, it's I'm just astounded by it, to be honest. It's such a move to have this, angelic ethereal character and then connect them directly to something like bugs, which would suggest the opposite thing.
Yeah, well, actually, that reminds me of what I think is maybe my favorite little sequence in the film. I watched it again in advance of this chat. And this bit, it hit me pretty hard the first time, but it really, really resonated with me this time around. And it's almost at the exact midpoint of the film where Jennifer's character, also called Jennifer, is at this school and is getting bullied viciously by all of the other girls around and is having a pretty miserable time. And she summons a swarm of insects that all gather and they're beating on the windows, and all of the bullies and the teachers are staring in kind of horror and amazement at this swarm of insects against the windows. And the lighting on Jennifer's face is suddenly all lit up like her sleepwalking. And she kind of stands apart from them and turns to them all and says that she loves them. She loves them all. And there's just something in the way that moment was staged, that it was almost like a horrific moment. You could see that this is the origin of kind of a great monstrous villain or something. Like, it just felt like accessing something really profound and really deep. And it's not explained ever. There's no literal explanation for what that moment was, but the feeling of it, whatever path that Argento and his co-writer got to that moment, it just taps into something. It's really, really special.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of it reminded me of the best of sort of apocalyptic psychic anime. You know, like it's like some of the moments of kind of loss of control and loss of identity in movies like Akira. You know. It's really, really something. The thing that I didn't realize was, and I discovered this through doing some reading around the side, is that this movie is sort of accursed for like Dario Argento and Jennifer Connelly and just its sort of general, like it was incredibly expensive because they literally imported bugs.
Yes,
from all around the world at enormous expense in order to make up the number of bugs they needed. Jennifer Connelly managed the chimpanzee took a dislike to her and attacked her at one point, and so she had to body double with someone who the chimp wasn't so angry at.
Her finger almost got bitten off.
Awful, absolutely awful. Yeah. And One of the teachers, who I believe is the one who turns out to be the villain, Frau Bruckner, is played by Dario Argento's then wife, who was so disgusted by the movie and particularly its treatment of disabled people, which is absolutely a reservation and a thing we can get into, that she that actually precipitated the breakup of their marriage and her saying that she was never going to work with him ever again.
Yeah, that's right. Their marriage did survive a while after that. Their relationship did carry on, but it was certainly never the same, and it didn't last that much longer. But in preparation for this, I wrote down what she said because, as you say, reserved recommendations. This gets to the heart of it. She said, after starring in this film as this villainous role, kind of the source of the trouble, she was so well placed to say, the basis of the film is unacceptable and reactionary. The heroes are rich and good-looking. The villains are poor and ugly. And the murders are perpetrated by a handicapped person and his crazy mother. She's absolutely right. All of those things are 100% true. And she's right to call them out. I don't know that I don't think that you can say Argento has kind of any malice towards the targets of people in his he's operating on maybe an intuitive level, but surely he has created something that does perpetuate some very unpleasant stereotypes.
I think in some ways that's actually like the source of the trouble, right? Is that he's operating so much on an intuitive level that he's kind of tapped into this disgust that maybe he has without even really knowing that he has it. And he's just kind of unquestioningly put that on the screen in the strongest way that he can, and as she says, it absolutely does position the wealthy and privileged people as either the heroes or the victims of this crazy woman and her like genuinely horrifyingly deformed child, who is like absolutely created as a sort of a monster, and like. There's a weird the thing about the Nightmare on Elm Street mythos that always made me really uncomfortable was the detail that Freddy was supposed to be the child of 1,000 rapists or something like that. That always struck me as just like a step that was unnecessarily gross. Along with everything else in the Nightmare of, I mean, there's so many of those movies and they're so diverse that they're not really coherent anymore, I don't think, as a single thing. But like that detail always struck me as particularly weird and gross. And Dario Argento draws on that as well. Like there's this whole murder investigation angle that's going on at the same time. And one of the turns in that investigation is the discovery that there was a nurse who was sexually assaulted by a patient at an insane asylum and then vanished. And this turns out to be Frau Bruckner, who's played by Argento's wife, who had the rapist's child in secret and has been covering up its murders because it's, I guess, ontologically evil. It's not really – I mean, but it does seem to be like the Freddy Krueger kind of original sin thing somehow.
Yeah. I think that's right. I think that's exactly what's going on. There's no explanation for the violence. It just springs from the inherent nature of the this young killer, and then the madness of the mother who's trying to kind of protect or celebrate, or it's hard to say exactly what she's trying to do by the end of it.
To pivot from things which are kind of awful to things that are kind of hokily entertaining, the thing that Argento seems to it feels like a thing he kind of picked up from kind of contemporary slasher movies is the idea that his slasher needs a signature weapon, and so all of the murders are committed with this sort of like collapsible knife whole arrangement.
Yeah, I couldn't work out what that was on either of my viewings, and I've looked at a bunch of kind of reviews online, and no one seems to know what it is there either. It's just a long middle pole that you screw together with a deadly knife on the end of it, apparently.
Yeah, because we needed to have a signature weapon, but there's no, like, it doesn't tie into his status as like a kid or a person who's maybe got, you know, less functional hands, or it doesn't seem to make anything easy for him necessarily. It's just a knife on a pole.
Yep. Yep, it is. It is. Who knows? It's like the shots of screwing this device together are kind of suitably unnerving. They look good on screen. And that's probably all the rationale that you need to have a weapon like that in a movie like this.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point. He has a knife on a pole, so you can see him assembling the knife on the pole, and you know that something bad is about to happen.
Yeah.
I know I'm kind of jumping all over the place, but one of the concerns one would have with a movie set at a girls' high school directed by, you know, someone who is fundamentally a 70s dude, is that it would be in some way kind of leering. And I'm like, I can't quite make up my mind where I come down on that one with this movie.
Yeah, this is in the pages of notes that I have written trying to think about this film before coming, I wrote several paragraphs on exactly this subject, because I think you're right that it's quite ambiguous. Dario Argento is... he has leaned in deliberately to the idea of being a creepy dude at numerous times in his filmography. And
he got his start in giallo, which is like a specific subgenre of crimey, slashery movie from Italy, which often has an element of sort of lurid sexuality to it as well. Like the kind of iconic giallo image is a beautiful woman on the floor covered with impossibly vivid fake blood.
Yeah, bang on, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
And so like the idea of kind of leering at beautiful women and positioning them as like objects that are threatened by violence is kind of in the DNA of the genre a bit.
Yeah. I think there is, I feel like Argento must have gone into this film not trying to kind of be too creepy, because it still hits a bunch of these kind of sexual exploitation tones anyway, but I think he just kind of can't help himself, that intuitive thing that we were talking about. But it could have been much, much worse.
Yeah.
Much, much worse. Yeah, there's lots of scenes of Jennifer Connelly, the actress, walking in these kind of flowing white outfits, and then you see her kind of fall, and you see a lot of her legs on display. And it's not really kind of a pervy camera, but it's not preserving her dignity either. It's just sort of, it's quite happy to just see everything there is to see without kind of becoming, like, you can't feel the sweat dripping down the director's face, which would be fatal to this movie, because you really need to identify with this, all these young girls who are in trouble here, and particularly Jennifer. And, yeah, but on the other hand, there is deliberate sexualization in there. She has a roommate who asks her if she's slept with this famous guy that she knows, who turns out to be her dad, who is obviously in a sexual relationship with a young man who comes to visit her in the night. Context that floats around the edge of, as well.
Yeah, and with that roommate, she does like take her top off in Jennifer's presence. She's shot from the back, but it is just the side of being like voyeuristic.
I think she's a bit older. I don't know the actress at all, but I think she's a bit older, both the character and the performer, thankfully. But still, yeah. Again, it's a film that you want to go into with some understanding that you're not. There's a lot of worse exploitative things out there, but this is not entirely innocent of that content either. Yeah.
Yeah. So I am talking to Morgan Davey about the movie Phenomena from 1985. It is an Italian horror movie by Dario Argento. We are going to continue that conversation in just a second, but it is around about the halfway point, so we will be back right after this.
If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawa 2, you could make your very own, just like this one. NPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out npr.nz for more information. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate. If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app.
You are listening to Reserved Recommendations, a radio show and podcast about great trash and difficult art. We are making this show at Manawatu People's Radio Te Reo Irirangi o ngā tangata o Manawatu with the support of New Zealand On Air, so cheers for that, guys. And we're talking about the movie Phenomena tonight with Morgan Davey. One of the iconic elements of a lot of Dario Argento movies is the soundtrack, because he had a long-standing relationship with this Italian prog band called Goblin. I think probably the best known soundtrack of his is for Suspiria, and they are here on this one. Although unusually for him up to this point, he also puts in a bunch of other contemporary heavy metal and hard rock songs. I think there's like Iron Maiden on the soundtrack and stuff.
Yeah. There's a bunch of stuff like that, which is a very, very different tone. And again, it's a subject that kind of fans of his work have puzzled at and are a bit kind of down on. I really like the way that he's using this music. I find it quite jarring and shocking. I think the first time he throws in one of these songs that actually has that roommate who watches the television, goes to sleep watching the television with headphones on, and it shows that she is watching a performance on stage, which I think is, I couldn't identify the band, but seems like a heavy metal band to me. And then this music kicks in on the soundtrack. And so there's kind of an active introduction to this new tone. But throughout the film after that, they just drop in more of this heavy metal music as opposed to the kind of unnerving synthy stuff that Goblin's doing. And it's I don't know, it certainly keeps me on edge. It gets the pulse going. I really enjoy it just as part of this kind of soup of so many different elements that are in this film that are all there's a crucial chimpanzee in this film that we have not made any time to talk about, and we're probably not going to get to. It's just that kind of film. There's so much in there, and this is just another thing. They couldn't just have Goblin in there. They had to have all of this heavy metal music as well, another ingredient in the stew. It's intense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, actually, you know, that's perhaps the thing that makes this movie, you know, it's been critically reappraised, I would say, but by Argento's standards, it wasn't one of his more successful ones when it came out. And I do wonder if that, like, everything all at once-ness kind of contributed to that. Because certainly it feels less all of a piece than something like Suspiria does.
Yeah.
Suspiria, again, not a movie that makes a huge amount of rational sense, but the vibe is a lot more kind of coherent throughout.
Yeah. I think if you are going to talk about a kind of weakness of the film, aside, of course, from all of the crazy unpleasantness that has not aged terribly well. But a weakness, I think, in the film is that it does have so much in it that it loses that kind of, what am I trying to say? Like the core tightness of focus that adds to the sense of claustrophobia that horror often thrives on. The fact that there are so many things happening almost gives you a get out clause, that it's a part of you can never get too worried about this film because it's so bananas and there's going to be some crazy twist happening around the next corner. So you're always kind of looking forward to the next thing. It's it is gruesome, but I think it's a good kind of it would be a great sleepover horror movie for a bunch of teenage girls to watch,
yeah,
who are worried about horror, or teenage boys for that matter. But I think about teenage girls because I have a teenage daughter myself who's getting into horror. This would be a good one to kind of broach that subject because it's not as intense as it gets, but it is as intense as it gets in terms of the kind of volume is always up very high, both literally and figuratively. There's so much happening and there's so much going on in there. But it doesn't give you that focus that can really scare, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, there is certainly a vogue, particularly in like more modern, I feel like it's particularly an American horror movie thing, or a horror movie that considers itself to have something on its mind, to like situate you with a person or a group of people who are like in and of themselves kind of unpleasant to be around, like, you know, making you sit in the car with a married couple who are on the brink of divorce and are just constantly bickering, or putting you in the making you follow around a kid who's being perpetually abused, or, you know, like that making the atmosphere really oppressive even before the horror stuff starts happening. And like you say, Phenomena is kind of, even though Jennifer is being horribly bullied by the other girls, like everything else that's happening is so off the wall or like weirdly disconnected, because anyway, we should get round to the crucial chimpanzee, but like there is also an entirely mundane murder investigation that's going on into this series of murders that's just happening at the same time as the ethereal girl who talks to the bugs. And it takes quite a long time for those things to intersect. For a long time, they're only really interconnected by the involvement of Donald Pleasance's scientist, because the cops want to talk to him about trying to like date corpses using insects, or like work out where corpses have been using insects.
Yeah. I think so. Just to switch tracks tightly, my kind of day job, so to speak, is I work in games, in role playing games, and I've been working on a horror game for a long time. I'll maybe finish with a little plug, so I can tell you where to go. But one of the things that I did analyzing lots and lots of horror was talk about something that I call the trap, which is just the rationale, the excuse that your main characters are going to be stuck in the horrific situation for the time they need to experience it, and what is it that's stopping them from getting out of there. And a lot of kind of weaker horror entries just kind of don't have a very strong trap, and you watch them and a part of you thinks, well, why are they going up the stairs? Why aren't they leaving? What is driving the characters to interface with what they're encountering? And I think there is a pretty amazing sense of being trapped in Phenomena as this character arrives at the school and has her freedom taken away. She's almost sectioned pretty quickly, and there's just the serial killer that sees her face, and while she's sleepwalking, and she's a target, and that's there's all of this stuff that's going on. But also, she is the daughter of this famous Hollywood star with incredible resources, and so there is this bit quite late in the film where she almost just flies out of the film, and they kind of need to sort of distract you a little bit before she finds herself caught up in the trap again, because they gave her such a significant set of power to extricate herself. And that, again, it's the sense of the film almost tripping over itself by putting so much stuff in there. The appeal of having a wealthy character with a famous father added so much to make this sophisticated boarding school experience, but there's consequences that come from that. And if we just kind of run at breakneck speed through the film, hopefully you won't think about it terribly hard. But yeah, again, it's just that little lack of coherence can give you some speed bumps along the way.
I mean, they eventually have to deal with that by having her father's agent have a sudden realization of the awful situation she's in back in America. And so you get this sequence towards the end of the movie of him like suddenly realizing that he needs to fly to Switzerland and rescue her and going through all the hassles of getting on the right plane, and yeah, it becomes just entirely about him and his travel difficulties for about 5 minutes before he turns up and is immediately decapitated with a piece of scrap metal. Just kind of out of nowhere.
Much like the Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, which has a similar thing happen with a character coming to the rescue, and you watch their difficult journey, and the moment they arrive, they are immediately killed.
I think by the time that happened, so I watched this movie with my wife, and she cracked up laughing at the first decapitation, the young girl who is killed in the Alps right at the start of the movie, which sort of sets the scene that there's something horrible going on, and you don't really find out who she is or how she connects to anything until about halfway through the movie. But it was just such an obvious model head, and it the decapitation itself happens off screen, but her head sort of shoots out over a waterfall, and it's so obviously a fake head, and it goes with such force, like it's been shot out of a cannon, that she kind of couldn't keep it together. And so by the point where the agent gets his head cut off, we were sort of hooting and hollering and waving at the screen at that point. We were thoroughly bought in by the madness of it all.
Yeah, that's so true. There's something glorious as well that all of this madness is unfolding in Switzerland, of all places. Argento, of course, is Italian, and so the kind of chaotic character of Italian society is a stark contrast to what you see in Switzerland, which is captured beautifully, I think, in the opening sequences here, where you get a sense of the newly arrived American encountering kind of Swiss style, and everything is very organized and very ordered and very timely. And certainly my experience traveling in Switzerland was very much like this, the incredible hills and the mountains everywhere, and it almost in real life, I remember, looked like a little model, a little kind of scale model train set that I was looking at, it except it was entirely real. And yeah, there's something very strange about the just nature itself is almost more orderly, little in the people and the culture. And to just throw this crazy vision of a bug woman and a chimpanzee and a deformed child and all this other stuff into the ordered Swiss society, I thought was really kind of a fascinating contrast that just sits quietly uncommented on in the film. But yeah, it's all there.
And the Swissness of the school is one of the things that's sort of weaponized against Jennifer, and because that's, you know, the headmistress is very, very authoritarian with her. And then when she has the episode where she summons all of the bugs and sort of has her great kind of psychic freak out moment, she's actually put into the hands of the mother of the murderer, which almost seals her fate. And the reason that happens is because they like lean on that authoritarian, like someone's going to take charge of this child and put them somewhere. And clearly they're too disruptive and scary to have in the school. We have to, you know, we have to lock them down and control them more closely.
Yeah. One of the fascinating, like I've gone on such a Wikipedia dive of this film. It's an amazing Wikipedia page. I recommend looking it up on Wiki and then just clicking. There's so many avenues to fall down. But one of them that highlights that I had no idea of from just watching is that Dario Argento has said several times since that he made this film with the understanding that it was actually taking place in an alternate reality where Germany won World War II. And so it's actually a Nazi reality that we are operating in. And it's not visible in any kind of real way. There's a moment where she wears a jacket that had belonged to one of the previous victims, and it's got a kind of shiny little iron cross in the corner, but there's not really any anything overt, certainly no more overt than that.
She has like a weird, I can't remember, because unfortunately I didn't manage to rewatch the movie again quite so recently, but there's a point at which she's out wandering on the street at night for some reason. I think she might be coming back from visiting Donald Pleasance, and she gets picked up by two German-speaking boys in a car. And they're like rude and uncouth and sort of sexually threatening, but and speaking German. But it wasn't like – I can see how that sort of fits with that, but it's not really obvious, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But as you say, the whole structure of that school and the way that it is rapidly leaping to her kind of experiences of sleepwalking as being something that needs to be ferociously controlled, and kind of the threat of mental illness and contagion. There is kind of a fascinating door that you go through when you start thinking about this as an organizing principle that Argento didn't really put on screen but had in his head, because there's a lot of kind of disability themes running through the film. Of course, the monstrous child that's the source of the evil is horrifically designed to be a horrifying visual appearance, and I don't know if it's based on any kind of real facial deformity that there might be. But
he's almost got something like the Predator mouth, which seems like it would be difficult for a human face to do, even if it went very wrong.
But the idea is certainly that it is kind of a disability as opposed to kind of a monstrous mutation or something like that. And on the other side, you've got, as you said before, Donald Pleasance's character, who's wheelchair bound, who uses a wheelchair and has this chimpanzee character who kind of acts as a nurse and an assistant to enable him to do everything that he would normally want to do. And I think you can see the Jennifer character as well kind of in that scale with the recurrence of these sleepwalking episodes, which again, it's a disability in the sense that it's putting her in little danger when she is overcome with these episodes. She goes wandering, she isn't aware of the hazards that she might be walking into, which in the normal situation could be problematic, but in a horror movie is, of course, death-defyingly dangerous. That sense that Nazism was all about the perfection of the body as the ideal and cutting out any aberrations from that, that's sitting underneath. Again, it's not a thing that is really explicated in any way, but it is sitting there to be noticed, I think. And it maybe it provides a little bit of a get-out clause for the deeply problematic nature of the child, that it's not just all disability is bad in the eyes of these filmmakers, that they have a much broader understanding, I suppose, of what that might mean.
Yeah. Another thing just kind of occurred to me while you were talking, which is that there is also a theme about like the fallibility of humans and of human systems. One of the, like you mentioned, when he's trying to talk Jennifer through her psychic connection to bugs, Donald Pleasance kind of talks about like the purer experience of animals as opposed to humans. And he's kind of suggesting that maybe she's closer to that in some way, and that's maybe what links her sleepwalking and her ability to communicate with bugs. And certainly the very final moments of the movie are a sort of chain of humans either attempting to hurt her or failing to protect her until she is finally rescued by the heroic chimpanzee,
yes,
who emerges out of nowhere to kill the killer with a straight razor, which is like it's an astounding final twist. But actually, like it is surprisingly coherent with the point that the movie's been trying to make about humans being sort of, well, either devoted to rules or selfishly devoted to themselves and thus being kind of incapable of overcoming this hidden evil.
Yeah. Well, that feels really right to me. Jennifer is strongly identified with kind of the natural world, the natural environment. She does a lot of wandering around in the forest at night, interacting with insects. And the film makes a point of engaging in lots of kind of landscape of the Swiss Alps and the forests, and it opens actually with this really long, slow upwards pan up a tree that goes up and up and up and up. There's a real connection with sort of the natural world that she is obviously intended to be seen as part of. But yeah, that contrast that you're pointing out about the limitations of human society and endeavor against that is quite nice. So one of the little wiki rabbit holes that I went down was into the a painter, Caspar David Friedrich, who was has a big piece in Jennifer's bedroom in the in this boarding school where she's staying. It's this enormous painting on the wall of the room that she's sharing with others, and it's a famous painting of a single tree in a landscape. So I kind of went digging to find out more about it, and he's an interesting guy.
He's the wanderer over the sea of fog guy, right?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. That's his most famous one. He's made a lot of his work kind of involves one or two figures in the extreme foreground, looking out at this amazing landscape that is beyond them, and. He's a very he's associated with romance, like that romantic in the technical sense of kind of great emotion and connecting with deeper meanings and the word of the sublime, connecting with the sublime, a glimpse of something kind of supremely deep and profound underneath the world that is seen. And I think that maybe that's something that we can just enjoy thinking about in relation to this film, that it's filling the screen with so many ideas and images, trying to communicate something deeper, some organizing principle that sits underneath the chaos. It's maybe a different approach of the overloaded stew of ingredients here, as opposed to the beautiful landscapes of Friedrich's painting. But I think that there is an attempt to reach beyond the obvious with this film.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, we are coming up on time. I think that's a really good place to end it, because I think, you know, like you said, this is a perfect kind of slumber party horror movie. It's got like some genuine horror moments, but also it is so over the top and wacky that it is hard to be it's not a movie that's going to give you nightmares, I don't think, even though Jennifer Connelly falls into a literal pit of skeletons and maggots. It's all so deranged and so over the top that I don't think you could like buy into it seriously enough to do yourself harm. But also, like you say, there is more stuff under the surface of it than you would think for a movie this gonzo.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we haven't even gone into the fact that the school is the Richard Wagner School, and that's a whole other thing that I'll leave listeners to enjoy clicking through the Wikipedia history page for Wagner and his time in Switzerland. And
I mean, certainly it makes perfect sense if we're thinking that the movie takes place in an alternate reality where the Nazis won. So, I mean, that's perfectly logical. I do like to do two things by way of wrapping up the show. The first is to ask if you have any other things that you would recommend that hit similar veins to this. I would say, like, watch more Argento, particularly like Suspiria, Deep Red. Those are the kind of big breakout giallo, like very over the top, kind of candy colored nightmare movies. Suspiria, in particular, if we're going to watch just one, watch that one.
It's a
Art Nouveau nightmare dream.
I mean, that is the obvious other recommendation. If you haven't seen Suspiria, then watch it. And if you have seen it, watch it again, because it stands up to multiple viewings incredibly well. And I think in as much as Phenomena is not kind of profoundly scary, Suspiria can be. That scratches something very unsettling in the ideas and the images, and it makes probably a lot less sense than this, which is saying something, but it's
a lot more suggestive, and he manages to kind of maintain that sense of being drawn into an awful fever dream much more consistently. So yeah, it is a real thing. And finally, do you have things to plug? I know that you have just been working on Five Evil, which is a big thing to plug.
Yeah, indeed. That is the big thing to celebrate at the moment. It's a tabletop role-playing game like Dungeons & Dragons. In fact, it takes the rules of Dungeons & Dragons and kind of turns them inside out to make them horror. And it's quite a special game. It's been published by Handiwork Games, which is an amazing company in Scotland. And they've just made this incredible visual experience of a book. It's out now in electronic form and PDF, and we're doing pre-orders at this stage for the physical copy, which will be along in a few months, I think. And I'm so looking forward to getting it in my hands and hearing what horrible experiences people are creating with the lengthy guidance and discussion in that book. I've kind of poured my heart and soul and love of horror as a genre into it, and I think it's pretty special.
I would like to put in an additional plug to say people should hunt back through your social medias if they can and find the promo that you've been doing for Five Evil, because some of it's really interesting kind of little mini essays about, like, why horror with D&D? What are we trying to do with this particular mechanic? And that stuff's really interesting. But also there was an extended sequence about being trapped inside of a TV by an evil skeleton, and that was a lot of fun as well.
Yeah. Hashtag Clive Evil.
You've been listening to Reserved Recommendations, a radio show and podcast from Manawatu People's Radio, Te Reo Irirangi o ngā tangata o Manawatu. The show was produced and presented by me, Hugh Dingwall, and I also composed our theme music. It's called Sack Jazz, and you can find it at wolfboy.bandcamp.com. If you enjoyed this show, why not go ahead and share it with a friend? You can find the last 10 episodes of this show at npr.nz/show/reserved on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts. If you want an episode older than that, try searching for Reserved Recommendations on YouTube. You can find me at Objective Reality on Blue Sky, or send emails to objectivereality@gmail.com. You can also follow Reserved Recommendations on Facebook or Instagram. And finally, Manawatu People's Radio is a non-profit community access station. If you like this or any other piece of their fine audio programming, why not fling them a dollar or two? You can go to npr.nz/donate for more information on how to do that.